Welcome to episode 290 of the Board Game Barbecue podcast, brought to you by Advent Games and our fantastic, awesome Patreons. Tonight, I'm your host, Adrian, back in the hot seat, and I am joined by, quote unquote, the old guard, right? Is that right? Are we the old guard? Are you the old guard? Is that what that means?
Sure.
Does it mean you're old?
Yes.
If Dan and I are the old guard, what does it make Dana? Prehistoric?
Maybe. I say
we'll take Dana's secret to our grave, but then she'll be in hers before us.
Don't ladies live longer than men in general? So maybe not. Anywho, I'm joined by Mitch.
You're probably right.
Hey, man, how you going?
Yeah, good. And Dan, how you doing?
I am unstoppable, Adrian. Thank you for asking.
Nice. So what have we all been up to? Well, what's been going on? Dan's unstoppable. So why don't you start off, Dan? What have you been up to? How's life?
Life's good. Been busy. Been playing a lot of games. I actually caught up with Joe, our fellow host yesterday. Went around to his place and he taught me, and taught a few of us actually, John Company, second edition. So I got to find out what all the fuss is about. I'm probably one of the last people on this podcast to play that. Really, really enjoyed it. Probably it's one of those games I think needs multiple players to really get the hang of the negotiation and what, because it probably took most of us a good couple of rounds, about round three that we all just went, oh, okay, I don't know what we need to do. And because you're kind of working together but not working together. And it's been talked about on the show before, but no, it was really good to experience that. But other than that, just been bumming around, revisiting some old games that I haven't played for a while. And I've got a couple of newies to talk about tonight too. It's been good.
Nice. And yourself, Mitch, what's been going on in Sydney?
I've been doing a little bit of gaming. I guess the highlight would be today. Today, Mel Layla and I just sat down probably just after lunch and decided we're going to smash through some more of our Ticket to Ride Legacy campaign. So nice. we did that at Savo. So we've played four games today, which took us time. But, you know, we're not rushing through it. You know, we're enjoying it. And this stuff that comes up, I won't go into too much detail because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who might want to play it. But, you know, maybe Dan and I could do a Patreon port or something on it later.
I think we have a Patreon coming up in a couple of weeks, so maybe cover it off then.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's throwing you new stuff every game. So you play a game, you finish, and you open up a new box and new stuff will come out. So it's kind of like there's new bits to learn, there's new dynamics every time you play a game.
Are you finding having a break from it and then going back to it hard to get back into it, or is it pretty easy? You've kind of got that save data and you're like straight back on and it's fluid.
I think the gap we left was too big the first time because it's been probably months since we've played it last time. So it took us a little bit we had to like go back through all the rules because we, you know, the stuff that we'd unlocked that was new to the game, we had to sort of refresh ourselves on all those and how they fit in. But then once we got into it, it was fine. And it's not like, you know, we're not talking like, it's not On Mars Legacy.
No.
You know, it's not some sort of super heavy game that you're like, oh my gosh, I have to relearn this whole game over because it's so complicated. Mm. It's Ticket to Ride, so it's relatively easy anyway. So maybe it took an extra 15, 20 minutes to just get a refresher on the rules, and bam, we're off and running again. So yeah, it was great.
We were playing it two players, Jen and I. So we threw, and it probably took us about 60 minutes each, 60, 70 minutes each game with three. Was it roughly the same or did it? Didn't blow out too much. Yeah, okay,
cool. No, I found that the very, very first games were very quick.
Yeah.
Very quick. As you start to sort of go along and unlock stuff and get more trains, each game, then the time gets a little bit longer. But I don't think you notice it because there's more to sort of chew on as you go through it. It's not just putting down the trains and going through the motions. There's all this new stuff that's added in. So you're winding all these new mechanisms and sort of different things into the game as you go.
Yeah, good call.
I've got a Jaws of the Lion campaign that's been going for over 2 years, and it's been like 14 months since our last game. And the people that I'm playing with are lovely. They're really nice people. They're MJ's friends. We only see them on very rare occasions, so we don't always get to table it, but they keep referring to to back to it and saying, oh, we should definitely meet up and play Draws the Line again. But I feel like I've just checked out. It's been too long. Like, for me to get back into it, I just don't see it happening. I think I'm just like, nah, let it die. It's gone. Next. Like, you know? So, yeah, it's just too hard sometimes.
It's funny you say that because we actually didn't finish the game. We got to the penultimate one, so we've still got one game left, which is the entire map now, and there's so many different things in play, and it's probably been 2 months. And I was only just saying to Jen the other day, we really should get this down and just finish it, because I want to know how much I've smashed her by, because I'm pretty confident that I am miles in front. But none of that is because you have like a little
vault.
Okay, we have a vault. I was going to go, do I say it or do I not say it? But at the end of each game, you pocket things into your vault, so you don't actually reveal who actually won certain bonuses or whatnot. It's really just done on cash only. That's right, isn't it, Mitch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's certain things towards the end where she may have the upper hand on certain things that I wasn't aware of, because she would have had secret objectives during the game and I had my own objectives. So just when I finished just game 12, just so we can crack open her vaults and find out what the final state of play is. I'm looking forward to it.
Mm. Oh, that'll be nice. That's a good mechanism for sure. Yeah. So.
And then the question is, what do you do with it?
Well, I don't know yet, because I haven't got to that point, so I'm not even sure if I'm assuming it's playable as just a big game.
I honestly don't know. Yeah,
I'm not entirely sure, but I mean, we've been playing today, as I said. I had to stop to come and record the podcast. I said, I've got to get on at 8. We've got a podcast to record, so I've got to go. And I said to Mel and to Layla, did you want me to pack it away? And they were both like, no, let's leave it on the table. You know, we've got nothing on.
Love
tomorrow,
that.
We might come back and revisit tomorrow night. And I'm like, wow, that's good. That's really good.
And it is fun enough. And as you said, it's quick enough to sink its hooks into a little bit and go, oh, let's just play one more. It's an hour and a half. Easy. Mm.
I feel like those legacy games can do that, though. They get you hooked. And once you're in on the story, even though it's not necessarily a narrative story, the story might be your own journey in the game and what you've created and what you've built and what you've stored away, like you were talking about before. I feel that kind of brings you back, because you just want to keep doing better, because you've got this sort of overarching self-narrative of, you know, this is what I've got, this is what I've built, and I've got all these different things and I'm adding and adding and adding constantly, and I want to see how I do at the end. So I really like that aspect of those games.
I think the best thing that Ticket to Ride Legacy does is that there's two moving paths to it. One is the story deck and the story you read at the start of each game, but then as part of the admin at the end of that game, you open up a new box or a new envelope and you add new things to it as part of the pack down or the sort of like the summary of that game. And so you're going, oh wow, look at this, we've got to play the next one now, because you can't wait to see how this new mechanic works or how this new sort of objective works. And so it just hooks you in. It's like a big cliffhanger right at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we've had a great time with it. It's been really good, and I'm keen to just knock out those last four games. And I think the girls are too.
Talking about legacy games, I've recently just started playing Dorf Romantic, the board game.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the Spiel des Jahres winner from 2023. I didn't realize it had unlockable components to this game. And I didn't even realize that it was based on an app and then got converted into a game. Hence, in the title, it says Dorf Romantic, the board game, which, I thought it was just a board game. But that's been really interesting. Have you guys played it yet? Or you must have seen it. But
seen it around, but haven't played it.
It's really good. I highly recommend it. It's a co-op map city kind of builder game where you have these objectives that you follow, and just like in all legacy games, the more you play it, the more you unlock. But there's also like these sort of, I'd say, side objectives that you do which give you bonuses and unlock different things on this sort of sheet. And we've played a few games of it and really enjoyed it. And you don't even have to do the unlocks if you don't want to. There's enough in just the puzzle itself to make it interesting. So I would highly recommend it. I think you'd really enjoy it, Dan. I think it's up your alley for sure. So,
it's been on my radar for a little while, but I wasn't really sure how far I wanted to sort of dive into it.
Well, it's a co-op as well.
Too many games.
It's kind of interesting in the fact that you're cooperatively building this city and this map and trying your best to complete objectives together. And it's not very long. I'd say a game would last less than 30 minutes with two players for one game. Easily. It's very simple. It's just placing a tile. That's it. Just placing a tile and trying to hit these objectives. There are a few minor mechanics into what you can and can't place at certain times. Yeah, it's very simple.
That sounds like less than 30 minutes just to place a tile.
Yeah, one tile, that's it.
You just do it really slowly.
Yeah. Or you can run with it outside and then bring it back in again and put it on the table.
Yeah.
Do that one.
But then when the next person places their tile, then you spend half an hour just adjusting them all to making sure they're all perfectly level and parallel.
Yeah.
That's how I play Scrabble. It takes me 3 hours to play a game of Scrabble. Someone bumps a table and it's like, right, I need half an hour just to sort these tiles out.
I think you guys would enjoy it. I think you should check it out, Dan, for sure. I definitely think it's your style of a game for sure, especially with the boys and with Janet.
Yeah, cool.
It would be a good one for them. It is on the very basic side, but it's a good puzzle. Like the game itself really has you engaged. And the funny thing is that MJ set a timer saying that we only had X amount of time to play, but we went way past that timer and we actually played a second game immediately after because we were like, screw doing the housework and the jobs. Don't worry about that. We'll figure that out later. But no, it was very good.
That's tomorrow's Adrian and MJ's problem.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So another game I actually was lucky enough to play was Galactic Cruise. Finally got to play Galactic Cruise. Yep. And I know you guys have played it. You both played it. And I thought it was
taught it at the Brisbane Game Day.
Yeah, I feel that it was definitely a good game. Like I wasn't blown away by it. I was blown away by the production. I mean, that was a phenomenal looking game. The art style, it really sort of, I don't know, for some reason reminded me of, you know, the Jetsons in a way, like these really crazy rockets and tubes and pipes and bits and bobs. But the premise was great as well. I really enjoyed the theme. I just felt like there was something there at the end of the game where I was waiting for like the big kind of combo crescendo and it just didn't happen for me. It might have been my inability to play the game, but I still thought it was a very solid game and an amazing first game from Keystone. I can't remember the name.
Kinson's.
Yeah.
Productions. Games.
But yeah, really interesting mechanisms and really interesting game, but it didn't fall flat. I just felt it was very long for the game. Like it was an incredibly long game, but
one thing I found with the game, having taught it a couple of times now, is that even though there's a lot there on the board, it's quite easy to teach because there's quite a natural flow of things to do and everything is in sort of a logical spot on the board. And so just taking it section by section, you've got the employees lounge, you've got all the different places where you can do your actions. You've got the contracts down the sides. You've got the marketing section over here. Everything just feels like it's in the right spot. And it's quite an easy game to sort of step through and teach each section. And it is one of those games where I found you do need to learn everything before you jump in. Like there's some games that when you do a teach, you can potentially go, I'll tell you all this stuff and then we'll get to that bit when we need to get to it. But when it's a worker placement, you kind of need to explain every single action so that someone can take their first move, if you like. And that can be quite daunting sometimes. But I just thought the flow of the game, the way it all works and where everything is placed, it has like a natural sort of step, a natural process to it, as opposed to, okay, you've just explained all these things and I don't even know where to start. There's some logical steps you can take. It's quite good. And the bumping mechanism is great because it means if someone's that doesn't mean it's blocked. You just bump them back to the employee lounge. They get a little bit of a perk, but you can still do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, awesome. There's no blocking, which is very good, especially if you're trying to learn the game, because if you had, if you couldn't bump people out, it would come to a head constantly, so. What else have you guys?
Well, take that out as well. People won't have to. People don't like, you know. I played with Jules, so you know he's intentionally taking things with the idea of he knows you're going there. You know, that you're going to have to bump him out. But if that was blocked, he's going to use that as a cudgel, right, against anyone who's maybe, you know, not thinking as many steps ahead as he is. So the fact that he can't just really limit you from what you're doing, I think that's a good thing.
Didn't he lose that game?
He did.
Yeah.
And he did lose it to, oh, hang on, who was it? Me.
Exactly. Why do you think Mitch has brought it up, Adrian?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, sometimes, especially in those kind of Euro games, trying to block people or relying on someone else to do something is the worst thing, because you're better off just doing your own thing sometimes, because trying to, not necessarily block people, but trying to rely on someone else to do something else, you end up just slowing yourself down rather than just, you know, keep accelerating forward. Yeah. So
I did think it was interesting when he did talk about it on the pod, he didn't mention anything about the fact that he'd lost by 1 point.
No, he didn't,
me.
Actually.
He didn't, yeah, didn't come up.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah, mysteriously just slipped off.
He must have just slipped his mind.
Must have forgotten. He must have forgotten.
That's it. So what else have you been playing, Mitch?
Oh, look, I've been playing some bits and pieces. There's another there's a game I've been playing that I've been trying to get my hands on for ages. It's really hard to get over here. There was a first edition done. I can't even remember who did. I think it was Victory Point Games that did the first edition, someone like that, who's since gone out of business and they're not publishing games anymore. And Worthington Publishing has picked it up and they've done a remake of it. So a new deluxe version, new artwork, new everything, but still the same game. And that's called Cruel Necessity.
Hmm.
And been trying for ages to get it over here, and I just can't find it anywhere. So I ended up just biting the bullet, paying ridiculous amounts of shipping and ordering it from overseas. And it arrived, and it's about, so Cruel Necessity is about the civil wars in the UK in the 1600s. So you play essentially the British. I'm going to try and, I think the British Catholics, I'm going to say, trying to maintain power and control of the British Isles, and you're putting up with resistance from within Britain as well, from the Protestant sort of wing within Britain, and also from the Scots and the Irish that are also trying to overthrow you or whatever in terms of your power. It's a cool game historically because it's built in reality. You know, it's inspired by the true events that happened. You've got all your event cards and things. One thing that I thought was really cool, a lot of these games are always driven by event cards or event deck where you turn it over and the things that happen in the game are actual things that happened in real life. The event deck in this game, you can choose to shuffle it, in which case you don't really know what's coming and it's quite random, or you can actually build the deck sequentially so that the events that occur happen in the same timeline and the time frame as they happened in real life.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Something like that is really cool. I like that because it actually plays out then how it actually really happened.
Any Guy Fawkes in there? Does it start off with that? Because that's pretty early 1600s.
It doesn't start with Guy Fawkes, no, but I can't remember if he's a part of it or not, to be honest. I can't remember seeing that card in there, or if it was like it might have been part of one of the color text
events.
I don't specifically recall. Yeah, but it plays like a kind of like a tower defense game, because you have fortresses in the different cities that you are trying to use to sort of retain power and control. And it's a solo game, I should mention that. So there's no multiplayer option.
Cool.
You're playing against the game. And each round the game, or the opponents, be it the Irish, the Scottish, and whoever, will advance towards London. And your fortresses will stop them. So if they pass through any of your regions or counties that have a fortress, they have to stop and deal with that fortress before they can continue to advance. So it's in your best interest to have fortified fortresses in each of those spots, because it's going to slow down their advance and they're going to move as quickly. There's an action point system where you then choose to spend your action points either reinforcing your fortresses or attacking the advancing armies, and that will push them back as well. So it is very sort of tower defensive in that respect. There are some cool mechanics in terms of your fortresses and the strengths of the fortresses. The difficulty is that it costs you an action point to move up in terms of build your fortresses, reinforce your fortresses, but when they attack it, they roll twice. So they're basically got double the probability of actually being successful at sacking your fortress as opposed to you. So it's almost like, yes, you can try and stem the tide. It's kind of like you sweeping the water off your back porch while it's pouring with rain 80.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can have some success, but it sort of feels like that water's always going to come back. No matter how fast you sweep, that you just feel like the tide's against you. You know what I mean?
Not anymore. So that's kind of cool. I stuffed a big 150-mil pipe in there. Water's gone now. Never come back.
Yeah. Nice.
But there's these political tracks that you also have to manage, and the same victory points that you could choose to spend on fortifying and fighting the armies and pushing back the groups physically, there's this political track that you can also spend your victory point, your action points on, in order to, you know, gain favor with the Scottish, you know, nobles, or to there's the different Catholic and Protestant tracks in terms of the religious political side of it as well. And your ability to move those tracks up or have those successful is then directly tied to your victory points, because those tracks will hold more victory points the more successful you are with those. The other thing is then you have these, I think they call them ability cards in the game, that come out, and they will give you certain powers that you can then utilize to do different things that sort of break the rules and give you ability to do special things. But in order to purchase them, you have to have certain levels on your political tracks, or it'll say you can't purchase this card unless you have X rating with, you know, the Protestants, or you have to have X with the Protestants and X with the Scots and X with the Irish before you can actually buy this card and use it. So you've got kind of these conflicting sort of priorities in terms of pushing back the armies, building up your fortresses, but then also working the political aspect of it as well, making sure your politics is all in check. So it's kind of really, I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was as a solo game, it's not super tough. It's not overbearing. It was an enjoyable, really well set in history game to play. And if you're in from that region, I don't know if you like the history of the UK, Adrian, coming from there, but I thought it was, really sort of hit that spot if you're into historical war games.
If it doesn't have Guy Fawkes in it, then I'm out. Basically, that's how I stay. I do like the history. The history is very cool. Like, there's a lot of it, and there's lots of different parts of it, and there's very interesting architectural things in the UK to visit. So,
The one thing I will say about it is, you're not sitting down to play this game at morning tea. It's going to take you a solid 2 to 3 hours, I think, or thereabouts, unless you're one of these people that just charges through. But, you know, typically as a solo game, you want to take your time and have a think about your moves and stuff. I personally do anyway. I don't like to feel rushed when I'm playing solo. So, yeah, it's not a short game. There's three different Civil War periods that you play through, and each of them is going to take you about an hour, I reckon. So, yeah, don't expect a snack.
And Dan, I hear you've also been playing some historical games.
Funny you should mention that. Yes, I've fallen in love with a new game. Well, it's not new actually. It came out last year, and it was on my radar, but I haven't heard it mentioned before. So, if anyone's into two player games, do not sleep on Match of the Century. Like, I've been playing this game this week with Jen. I love it so much. I almost just was going to sizzle it today. But the game I'm going to sizzle a bit later on, I love just a little bit more. But this is a chess game. Well, it's a game about chess, and it has chess pieces, but it's not a chess game. The theme is the 1972 World Chess Championship between Boris Spassky from Russia and Bobby Fischer from the USA. And Bobby Fischer went to the championships that were in Iceland, in Reykjavik, and tried to win and tried to break Russia's, I think it was like 20 something years in a row of dominance. And this is a game, it's a two-player head-to-head game by Paolo Mori, who did Blitzkrieg and Caesar under 20 minutes. I think he did some dogfighting ones as well. So he's got a pedigree for really tense, really tight, close two-player games. And the game is played over a series, it's played over a series of games that are designed to kind of simulate chess matches, and the first person to win six games will win the overall match, the match of the century. And the way you play is with a deck of cards. So Bobby Fischer has 16 blue cards, Spassky has 16 red cards, and the cards are actually asymmetric. So the power is a little bit different. Like Bobby Fischer, his actions and abilities are slightly different, but all the cards are still numbered from 0 to 5. And you put the board goes in between you, and on one side of the board is the track, is an advantage track where you decide when you actually move a marker up and down the advantage track. And on the other side, you've each got a king, and that's where you move it. And the first person that gets to the middle wins six games and actually wins it. But the middle of the board, there's four columns, and the columns represent exchanges. And so white goes first. Yeah, there's actually a white queen that goes in front of Bobby Fischer. So Bobby Fischer always starts the game. And so Bobby Fischer has white cards. And he places a card from 0 to 5 in one of the four columns. And then Spassky has to actually play in the same column. You can't choose a different column. And whoever's card is highest will win that exchange. And the exchange is are numbered from 1 to 4. And whatever column you win, that's how far you move along the advantage track. So if you win column 3, you'll actually move 3 spots. You'll have three spots of advantage on the advantage track. However, before you take the advantage for the win, whoever loses that exchange gets to activate the action on their card. And the action might be an advantage for them for later in the game. Maybe they can draw another card, or they can get some other effect, or it can be a disadvantage for the other player. So it's kind of like that I cut, you choose kind of mechanism, where just because even if I win the exchange, I'll get points towards winning the overall game, but you'll gain an advantage that you can potentially use for the next exchange, if you like. And so it's usually some sort of buff for yourself, or it's a disadvantage. And sometimes that disadvantage comes in the form of mental agility. So in front of each player, there is a mental agility track. And the marker goes right in the dead center of the mental agility track. And that determines at the start of the game how many cards you have. And Spassky actually has 7 cards and Fischer starts with 6. And it actually lets you draw 2 pawns as well. And the pawns you can use, there's 2 little spaces between each exchange. We can add a pawn to increase your number. So even though I said the cards are numbered from 1 to 5, you can play a 5 and still lose if your opponent plays a 5 and then adds a pawn to it, making a 6. But if you lose with a 5, the buff that you get from losing with a 5 is usually really sweet. It's usually quite powerful. And it can be that you move your opponent's mental agility down a couple of spots, which means for the next game, they might start with less cards, they might start with less pawns. And if your mental agility goes up, you might start with more cards at your disposal and more pawns. And having more pawns means that you can actually increase more of your cards. So After the buff or that action has taken place, then you score the advantage and you check to see if the game is over. If you've won, if you've got more advantage, then the other person can possibly catch up. So if I've won 7 points because I've actually won the column 4 and column 3, then Adrian can't win because there's only column 2 and 1 left. So he's only going to win a maximum of 3. So then the game is over. You'll move your king 1 space up, and then you've won the first game. And again, like I said, it's 1 to 6. Mm-hmm. Then you move the queen, the white queen, to the other person. So then Spassky will have the white queen and Spassky will go first. And the black cards that he has, you rotate them 180 degrees and now you've got white cards. And I'll rotate mine and now my white cards are black. And so the numbers are different. So you might have some when you're playing black, you might have some like a 4 and a 3, but when you rotate them to white, they might be 1s and 0s. And so there's that real balance of, okay, I'm going to lose this one now, but do I play this card now? Because for the next game, I'm going to rotate my cards when I play the opposite color, and they're not going to be worth very much. So sometimes, just like chess, you might lose an exchange to gain an advantage later in the game. It's so clever. The other thing is, if it's a tie, so whoever wins the exchange goes next. If it's a tie, then the next person, so you lose the initiative, and the other person will actually start the next exchange, which can be good and bad, because sometimes you don't want to go first, because then if you go first, the other player knows what they have to beat, and it puts you in a better position as to whether you want to win that exchange or not. If the game is a tie overall, then both kings will move, so both players will actually gain a win. And then you go on to the next one. Again, it's first to six. And the games that we've played with Jen have been really tight. I think it's been like 6-5, 6-4. I don't think we've even had a 6-3. I think they've been sort of 6-5, 6-5, 6-4. The game just feels super, super balanced. Mm. And it's a lot of fun. I love those two-player games that just feel like a real head-to-head sort of cat and mouse sort of style game. And it's really, really clever.
Yeah, nice. It sounds up Jules's alley and completely out of mine, because I'm not very good at that. I'm just not good at that. If I'm head-to-head with someone, I'm always like, I'm the dummy. Like, I'm not going to get this.
But it has such a great balancing mechanism. When you lose the first exchange, you gain an advantage that you can use later on, even if it's just drawing a couple more pawns, so that suddenly your 5 can become a 7 and you can dominate at least for a couple of exchanges to catch up. And then that evens it out. It's it's really, really clever. So
it looks pretty great.
Yeah, match of the century. Nice. Yeah,
the people right, like the big chunky pedigree. So
his two player games are always really, really good. So, but the components, they're simple. They're literally chess pieces. The white queen you move from side to side, so you know who starts. That you got the kings and the pawns. They're all like really chunky sort of wooden chess pieces. And it's clean. The game also comes with a historical book. It's about sort of, I don't know, 18, 20 pages, which goes through the entire history of that World Championship series and the sort of the back and forth and all the politics that was behind it. So not since Rocky IV have we seen such a sort of, the media was so involved in this America versus Russia chess match. It's such a cool little game. If I get a few more games under my belt this year, it could even crack top 10 for me.
Oh, wow.
Nice. I love it. Yeah.
Well, talking before, Mitch, to swing back to you about long solo games, I've been playing Salton Sea, which is a 1-4 player game. However, I don't think I'd ever play this again other than solo. This is brutal, I hear.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah, I just find that it's too long between the turns. Like, if it's in a four-player game, you do your thing, and then everyone else does their own thing, and it's a long game already. And even a two-player with a metronome system, you know, of just going back and forward, back and forth between the two players, it's still a long game. I find that this game for me, and I've only played it at two, and I've played it on my solo. And for me, I would just keep playing it solo. It was very heavy, very tight, ridiculously tight game, an insanely tight game. But I kind of liked that. But I don't feel that there's no real interaction amongst the players. So therefore, I don't see the need to play it at four players. I would happily lend this to someone to borrow and play, but I really feel that if there's no interaction and there's nothing to do on my off turn, then I would much rather just play it by myself.
And if it's as tight as you say that it is, then tight games generally sort of produce more analysis paralysis.
Oh yeah,
because it's so tight. You really don't want to make mistakes. You don't want to take a turn lightly. Mm. You want to make sure you've thought everything through, you know. So I assume that would probably be a factor as well in this game, I'm guessing, because I haven't played it.
Well, 100%. I give you a very brief overview of some of the mechanisms in it, because it is a very – for the box size, it's a small box game, same kind of size as Red Cathedral and The White Castle. It's also made by Devere Games, same publisher. Mm. It's just, it packs a punch in the brain crunch department. Like, it really does make you think, because the main kind of mechanisms behind it is kind of like pipeline. You really can back yourself into a corner where you realize a couple of turns in, I've just screwed myself, and it's going to take me two or three turns to get back on the front foot. And that can be quite frustrating for players. I found that through some of the things I've read on BGG and some of the feedback that I've seen, people do find this game quite frustrating because of that. But I've now played it three times, and I've, like all these games, the first time I played it, man, I was stuck. I was scraping and scraping, like couldn't get anything to work. And then by my you know, my second solo experience, I was much more efficient, much more capable and able to get the engine moving.
So what's the theme, Adrian?
So the theme is basically there's a lake system between California and Mexico, and essentially you are drilling down into the bed of that to remove brine and turn that into geothermal energy or lithium. And this is a real lake. This is a real scenario. We actually do this right now. And essentially you buy land rights for where you're allowed to drill. And then you drill down and you harvest the brine. You do different mechanics and stuff to process it and then sell it to markets and also fulfill contracts, kind of just like a normal Euro game. There's all that kind of bits to it. But you start with $7 and your $7 are your main actions. So as you take those actions, you can no longer spend that money in that round because you've put it down on the tableau and put a worker on it. That is now, that dollar has now gone. You've got your $6 left, but you might want to take a couple more actions that cost more money, and then you end up getting a bit stuck. So you really have to buy and sell quite a lot to try and increase your funds very gradually over turn after turn to get the engine off the ground. Because when you discard or spend your money, it goes into this sort of market discard pile, because there's three sets of actions, one being dollar actions, $3 actions, and $5 actions. And essentially, when you spend money, it goes into that market's discard pile and it gets shuffled back into the deck at the end of your turn to the bottom of the pile. However, you don't get any change. So if you want to do something that's $4, you have to spend the $5. You don't get a dollar back. So you can't swap actions and pay for something and take another one as change. So that market buying area is very crippling at the start. And I mean, when I say at the start, for the first hour of the game, because it's a good 2 hour long game at solo. So you really have to have foresight and see the bigger picture of like, I'm going to spend this card and I'm going to lose this amazing $5 super pumped up action, but I'm going to take it now and I'm going to have to work my way back up the ranks again, sell some brine, sell some bits, and then buy more actions that are more powerful for later on. It's just super interesting. Like, that whole mechanism I found really engaging, especially as a solo player. Like, I'm not big into solo, but having that there as my kind of real thought process was really interesting, and I really enjoyed that aspect. In multiplayer games, there's just more of a market. You just add extra cards to make the market bigger so that at the end of the round, you know, you discard the one off the end, slide everything down and refill it. So at the end of the round, there's still, you know, in a four-player game, there's still six $1 cards to purchase. But yeah, I really enjoyed the game, but it would terrify me to try and play it at four, because I just think it would be too long, man. Like, especially with me, I'll be talking rubbish, getting chips, having a drink, talk about something completely different for 10 minutes, held up the whole game. No one's done anything. Back to the game, and we're like 10 minutes behind a three-hour game. Yeah, I don't know. And there's not a lot of interaction, so that it, to me, it's a needless thing to have it, because there is no real interaction. When you sell stuff and you buy shares in particular companies in the gangs, there's three companies, you don't, there's no market manipulation. It's just like a track with a multiplier. So it's not like you can dump shares and sell things to screw out other players. It's essentially just a score track multiplier system, but they just call it buying shares as the action, which increases your multiplier. But that's not besmirching the game. It's just that I just found that for me, I would only play this on my own, because it was just,
I would take this with your kind of game.
Dude, I would take this with me on holiday. I'm not kidding. Like, it's not a big box, but it packs serious, serious brain burning crunch for something that's basically the size of an A5 piece of paper. Yeah. And the production value is really good as well. I really like the aesthetic look. It's very simple. It's almost like a Kanban EV if you got it off Temu. Like, it's that kind of a look. It's just very basic, but it works. Do you know what I mean? And
well, it's funny because I had no idea of the topic. Having looked, I had seen the box before, and I just remember it had like sort of nice soft pastel colors on it. I didn't notice the big oil rig in the background on the lake. I just thought it was just
burning
some
away.
Sort of soft, sort of medium weight game with a really clean look to it. I had no idea it was as intense as what you've described. Certainly sounds just like your kind of game and not mine.
Yeah, exactly right. But yeah, like I said, I would take this around with me because it would be a great game to play if you're on holiday at the beach or something, because it, or you know, a restaurant if you're on your own and the other people are doing stuff or gone to bed, because you could play this game and it would kill 2 hours no problem. And it was really,
but it's not like small table space though,
not,
is it?
Not overly small. No, it's regular board game size table space.
So you're not really playing it at the beach.
Oh, that's what I was confused about.
You could, like, if you're at like if you're at a restaurant or something, you've got a normal beach table. Yeah. Maybe you want to role play it and get the oil
leave
yourself.
The tower and go into the lifeguard tower and set up in there. Then maybe you can play it at the beach.
Yeah, but for me, I'm just sort of getting more to the point of like, I'm kind of overtaking just party games places and just, you know, smaller games. Like, this game you could take in your backpack anywhere and it's not hard to carry. If you were a traveling salesman or you're going away for a work trip or something and you knew you're going to be at the bar for 2 or 3 hours and nothing to do and all you're going to do is sit in your hotel room and watch Disney Plus, Bob's Burgers, like...
No, I'm sure the restaurant would love it if you went down there and took up three tables just to spread your board game out there just while you have some bread and water.
Yeah, wow.
For 4 hours.
I might buy a pad thai or something. You never know if they're lucky. But yeah, like,
sorry, you mind if I join these four tables together just so I can play a board game while I'm eating my $10 lunch?
That's $10 with a drink, though. Don't forget. You've got a drink, that complimentary drink. But yeah,
and if it's Suntory lemon, he's buying 100.
Not at $30 a pop. I only drink them.
He's not buying.
Exactly. But yeah, it is a very interesting and it's got a lot of depth to it. But I just found that for a game that I was so excited for, I was like, this was one of my most anticipated games for this year. Just with that lack of player interaction for me now has just, it made it fall a bit flat in that department. However, I would play this solo, no problem. I've actually got it still set up on the other table over there to play again during the week. So, but that's Salt and Sea, worth checking out if you like a heavy, crunchy solo game. So, well, it's not solo. Solo, not solo, but you know what I mean.
Speaking of solo games, if I can have the mic next. I received a game this week from our good friends and supporters at VR Distribution. Trekking Through History. So I was a backer and fan somewhat of their last game, Trekking the World, which is where you went around a map of the world and you did research different locations and you got different sort of sightseeing cards and things like that to build up points. And that was okay. It didn't wow me. It wasn't a crazy good game. It wasn't a bad game. It was a good game for sort of that light entry level sort of family space. And I did play it a few times with my family and enjoyed it. And then I'd seen some reviews of Trekking Through History and people saying that it was also really, really good. So I thought, I've got to see if I can get my hands on this and check it out. And I did so. And one thing that it has that Trekking the World didn't have was the solo mode built in. So that, again, ticked a box for me because it means that I can play it solo. And so I did check that out recently solo and it meets the brief. I don't really get the theme. The theme is that you're traveling through history and you're checking out different sites and different events that have occurred through history. Yeah, it's kind of like a bit of a needs a theme to be adventure there just for something. Yeah, a little bit like that, I suppose.
That's funny. My first thought went to Carmen Sandiego because there was Where in the World's Carmen Sandiego. Then there was Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego.
But yeah, it's a very simple game. Definitely on that gateway sort of family level weight wise, where it's a card and resource collection game where when you're collecting the cards are different points in time and history, different events. So you can take the cards when it's your turn, read the back of them. You get a little bit of an education about what that historical event was, which I think is cool, especially if you're playing with kids. You can get them to read the cards and they might learn a few things about some different things that have happened through history. And every time you're taking your turn, you're trying to keep your timeline together. So if you start with something that's, you know, 3000 BC, then the next card you choose has got to be, you know, closer to the present day in terms of time, and continue along like that. The more that you can keep a timeline intact, the more points you'll score at the end of the game, because the end of game scoring is about, you know, how many cards you've got in each of your timelines. If you take a card that doesn't fit within the timeline or is going to throw the timeline out, you have to close down one timeline and then start a new timeline. And that then will, because the points you get are exponential based on how many cards you've got in each of your time tricks. So that's essentially what you're trying to do, is maintain that timeline and continue to build the timeline as you go. There's some pretty other cool little sort of side mechanics in it. It has the turn sequence is managed by a clock that you move around. So different cards, when you take a card, you have to move a certain number of positions around the clock. And then it's the person who's at the end of the clock who goes first. So if they continue to take cards that are only small movements, they might get a couple of turns in a row because they're always at the back. It's always the person at the end who takes the turn next. And there's another little sort of resource puzzle where you're taking different tokens that will come up on different cards. And as you fill out those tracks, you get different track bonuses as you move each of those tracks down. That's the whole game in a nutshell. So I haven't had a chance yet to get to get my wife and daughter to play it, but I think it's something that will really hit with them. I think it's something that will really hit with people that, you know, like a little puzzle, like to be able to get into something without a 45-minute rules teach, because this thing you could teach in 5 minutes.
Mm.
In terms of the solo mode, really simple. You essentially just take the next lowest card available in their timeline that won't, you know, throw their timeline out of whack, and that's it. And then you move on and you take your turn. So it's super smooth in terms of not having to manage, you know, a really cumbersome AI from the solo mode, and a really easy game to get into. So yeah, from a family weight perspective, I think it's something, Dan, even with you and your boys.
Yeah. Would it be too advanced? Should I maybe look at Trekking the World first?
I think this is probably lighter than Trekking the World.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think this is a bit easier. It's literally on your turn. The biggest decision space is, what card do I take? Maybe the only challenge they might have is trying to work out that anything before, like, BC.
Yep.
Counting down, whereas once you cross over and into AD, you're counting up.
Oh yeah. See, we bought the boys Timeline for Christmas last year. It might have been the year before, and quickly realized that they had no concept of when things were invented. Like, no idea. As far as they're concerned, it's everything that they use now and everything that was ancient all goes in the one bucket, and they don't know what came first and what didn't.
That's brilliant. You don't have to know that.
It's not a trivia game.
It was interesting. It was a good learning experience for Jen and I. Just going, okay. You think the washing machine was invented before? I don't know, the wheel.
Dinosaurs.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, yeah. All right then. I guess we're gonna. I guess the school system in Victoria is failing our kids.
But yeah, I don't think they'd have any problem with it. Because they don't need to work anything out. They just need to be able to say, well, 1700 comes before 1800.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. I need to take that card first, you know, in order to keep the sequence going. So I guess there's a little bit of math there as well in terms of making sure the timeline stays intact.
Mm.
But yeah. So I think it's really sort of fits that family space perfectly.
Well, if it's all right with you guys, we might move on to our highlights for the week and our sizzling games. And we might do it in an alphabetical order. And because Dan starts with a numerical number, I think, Dan, you should go first. So off you trot.
Oh, we're doing the games in order. Okay, all righty. Well, then it's time for me to sizzle Seventh Citadel. This is a game I've been sitting on for a few weeks now. It was my oath because I wanted to get a few games under my belt before I actually talked about it. I didn't want it to just be – I pretty much cracked it open as soon as I got it. I sleeved it and I played the opening prologue almost straight away, but I didn't want to talk about it on the show and just have sort of, you know, first impressions. I wanted to sort of dive into it a little bit. So I've had the opportunity to sink quite a few games into the first threat. So Seventh Citadel, it's a sort of a follow-up, but it has nothing to do with the Seventh Continent that came out many, many moons ago. And it is an exploration slash adventure slash deck management, deck builder game. And it's set in a realm that's called the Collapsing Lands. And the Collapsing Lands is, there's quite a broad sprawling land. There's a city of Kel, there's a couple of different cities, and there's citadels all across. And the lore, which I'll go into later, is quite deep. But there are some citadels. There are these creatures called the Burrowers that are like giant worms, not as big as your worms from Dune, but big worms that are causing absolute chaos throughout the land. They're making that's why it's now called the Collapsing Lands. But there's also different sects. So there's some necro druids that are fighting against the Burrowers, and there's a couple of different cults and religious factions and all this stuff going on. And the game picks up with you choose a character, and you're a lowly gardener that are basically forced to tend to the gardens in the Citadel. And then when you're not working, you're locked away. And then due to the Burrowers, the Citadel starts to collapse. And so the first opening prologue sees you trying to escape the Citadel, trying to escape, you know, being a servant, and then escape into the realm. And the prologue kind of dumps a lot of the game at your feet. And I'll get to that. It's one of my sort of my nitpicks of the game. But you start by choosing a character. You get a certain number of cards that go with that character that start to form your action deck. You can take a whole bunch of skills, and then there is a massive amount of what's called advanced skill cards in the game. I mean, there's things like lockpicking and things that are with good fighting and dexterity and determination and those little buffs which you can use to help you during the game with skill tests and whatnot. But there's opportunities. You don't get very many, but there's opportunities later in the game to grab more and learn more skills and then really, really flesh your deck out, because the deck itself forms what is essentially a ticking clock. Now, in Seventh Continent, there was a lot more cards, and it was a ticking clock. Once the deck completely expired, then it was almost game over for you. Whereas with this one, you start off with a certain number of health points, and then once you go through all of your action cards, you can then take them from the discard and put them back into your actual deck at the expense of your health. And if they say that it should be a 1-2. So you can take two cards from your discard, put it back in your deck, and then lose one health. If you want a survival mode, you do 1-1. And if you want to play just the story mode, you can do 1-3. So it gives you a bit of flexibility in terms of, I just want to enjoy the story. I'm not interested in making it too tough on myself. You can take cards out of your discard. You can put three cards back in your deck and just lose one health. I've just been doing it on the standard, which is 2-1. But it means that once you deplete your deck, you can then still, and I think the first couple of stories, the first couple of adventures, you start with 45 health. So you've got a lot of flexibility. But then there's all the usual skill tests that from the last game, they happen in this game as well. So a skill test might be opening a door. It might be meeting someone and trying to convince them to give you information. There's all sorts of different things. It might be attacking a creature. It might be something as simple as just jumping a gap. And whether you pass or fail could be whether you take an injury, it could be whether you completely fall and crumble.
What denotes if you pass or fail?
Yeah, so you have to the skill test itself will tell you how many cards you must draw from the deck and how many stars you must get on those cards to pass the test. And it's usually something like 2+. So you need to draw at least two cards, but you can draw more if you want to. You can draw as many cards as you want to try and get those two stars to pass. But of course, the more cards you draw, then you're depleting your deck. And all you're going to do is put, now some of the cards will actually have a star on them. Some of the cards will have half a star, and you can put put cards together to form a full star. So if it says 2+ cards and you need two stars to pass the test, you can take just two cards and hope you get two stars. You can take five cards if you want. You're more guaranteed to get those two stars you need, but then again, you've taken extra cards out of your deck. Now, this game also, Seventh Citadel also introduces an interesting mechanism, which is it's got a chain symbol on it, and it might say chain of 2+. So you can take more than 2 cards if you want, but you can only use 2 cards to pass the test with the stars. So you might draw 5 cards, hoping that you've got two cards with a single star, or at least 2 cards that will make 2 stars on them. Some of them are even harder. Some of them will have it. You can draw as many cards as you want, but you can only use 2 to gain 5 stars to pass the test. And those skill tests are a lot more hard, a lot more difficult, but you can use action items. So you can use items you picked up along the way to either increase the amount of cards you can use or reduce the amount of stars you use. And some of the skill cards that you use when you draw out of your deck, quite often, and one of the easiest ways is whenever you move in the game, you have to use 1 card, take 1 card out of your deck and put it in the discard, but you can also keep it if you want to. And you're allowed to carry up to 4 skill cards. And the skill cards are quite unique. One of them might be specifically 2 fighting. So if the skill test is a fighting skill test, you can use that one to maybe give you a free star, or it might be actually to increase the number of cards you're allowed to use. So during the game, as the skill tests get more difficult, you will have things at your disposal to try and mitigate that difficulty and either increase the number of stars number of cards you can draw, or reduce the number of stars you need to pass the skill test. So that's really, really cool. Like I said, the prologue, that's one of my biggest bugbears with the game, and I've seen a lot of comments online. I've had a conversation with Mitch about it, and Mitch can probably share his comments about it as well. But the prologue is tough, okay? Tougher than Woodpecker Lips. But I think the way they've done it that way is to give you a taste of all the different mechanics. So there's movement, and it's not just movement from one location to the next, but there's when it's uneven terrain or it's difficult terrain, then it costs additional cards to move out of that space. You've also got a weight limit, so there's certain things you can carry, items, objects or otherwise, that will actually slow you down a little bit too potentially, and so again you're going through your deck a lot quicker. There's some skill tests that are also like almost like a double or a triple skill test. So once you pass the first skill test, then you go to the second one, then you go to the third one. Particularly if you're fighting a creature, or it might be like a horde of creatures, you're almost attacking them one at a time. And even if you do pass the first skill test, you move to the second one, but you still take a wound from the first one sometimes. Or you might actually, if you pass the skill test, then you can actually discard the card. Or if you fail the skill test, you take a hit and then you go on to the next one. So it's almost like if you succeed, the other two might run away. But if you don't succeed, then you move on to the next one. You still have to fight the second and the third one, and that gets more difficult. So it's kind of tough. But at the same time, I think one of the reasons they've done it is because later in the game, once you start the main thrust of it, which is around these threats, the game comes with these 2 threat books, which are a series of adventures that are all linked to an overarching story. There's 2 that come with the game. There's a third one that comes as an expansion. The one I've started with is the one they recommend. It's called The Drums of, I remember the guy's name now. It's one of the Necro Druids anyway. And so, and those adventures actually start off quite tame, quite easy. And they're almost like fetch quests. You got to go here. And all it does, it tells you got to go east. And so you're venturing east and you're trying to find a certain objective or certain objectives and then come back. Because what happens is when you escape the Citadel at the end of the prologue, and this is the part, one of the things I really love about this game, is you go to a settlement and you start to form a bit of a city, and you'll get certain things that you can build as the game goes on in your settlement. And at the start of every new quest, you can check those buildings. And if you've bought a grain silo, you can gain a production. You can gain more food. If you've built, for instance, an apothecary, you can start your next quest with a potion. You can, if you've got a blacksmith, you can start that next quest with a sword. And so it's more closely resembles a PC game than any board game I've ever played before. And that includes the previous one, Seventh Continent. It's also got what's referred to as a destiny track, which is kind of more like a spider web. And there's certain points during the game where you earn destiny points, and you can, starting from the middle, you can sort of go out from that, out from the center and mark certain things off. And again, you can build buildings, or there's 4 different tracks that you can mark off in this booklet that you get. You can mark off, you can increase production, you can increase defense, you can increase your knowledge, and you can increase your influence. And they all start at zero. And I think the maximum is like 20 or 25. But then there's certain things that during the quest where you might meet someone, and they'll, and if you have, if your knowledge is five or more, then there'll be one result. And if not, you'll get a different result, or potentially you discard the card altogether. Because another thing the game comes with is a dialogue book. And this is new to the seventh, to Serious Pulp series. The dialogue book, because there's a lot more people, there's conversations, there's dialogues you have with people that you meet in the world. Whereas Seventh Continent took place entirely on this, well, it's an island, but it's a, let's say it's a continent. But you're pretty much on your own doing exploration, trying to break this curse and get off the island. This one, you've got different quests where you might actually have to go and meet someone. You might have to get something off them, or you might encounter guards from the city of Kell along the way. You might, there's complete strangers. Do you trust them? Do you not trust them? If you've got, if your influence score has been built up over time, then you might be able to sort of convince them of something or negotiate something with them. And so it really does have that sort of RPG feel to it, like some of the, you know, some of the games that would play on PC. The other thing I really, really love about this game, and there's a mechanism called the ground shiver, and it's a flower that you get. And the ground shiver, at the start of each adventure, it'll say your ground shiver is set to level 3. And so as you're going through the game, and it's if you've played Seventh Continent the same way, you start with a tile, which is your map. And then once you put it down, you'll put three exploration tiles or two exploration tiles, north, south, east, and west, around it. And they're the directions that you can go. But before you go there, you need to explore that area, which is by flipping it over. And if it's a level 1 explore card, then it's usually some sort of simple skill check. It might even be good. You might just find something that you can stash in your backpack or whatnot. And what these exploration tiles will say, this is free to flip over. If your ground shiver is... it's set at 3, it's you can flip it over. If it's less than that, then you need to spend cards. And then the further you stray away from the Citadel, it'll be, this is free to flip over if your Grand Shiver is level 7. If not, you need to flip over 4 or 5 or 6 cards. So you can go off the beaten track a little bit and explore the realm if you want to, but it's going to cost you more cards from your action deck if you're straying into territories that you probably shouldn't, because the ground shiver sort of setting kind of sets some guardrails in the land where you need to be. And you can venture further afield and at the expense of your action deck. And it could be quite rewarding. You could get some really, really cool benefits out of it. You might also meet some creatures that you're completely unmatched for. And I kind of liken it to like when I play Horizon Zero Dawn or Assassin's Creed, where you're going to a place where you know you probably shouldn't go into, and then you get there and you're so underpowered. It's like, oh, I got to get the hell out of here. I can't fight them, or I can't do that action skill test. So it still feels open worldy, but it still puts those little guardrails in with the ground shiver sort of setting. So that's one thing I really, really love about the game. My other nitpick is that it comes with this map, which is such a really cool idea, that you can, as one of the destiny tracks, you can actually send people off, and that will help you explore the outside realm. And it comes with this big PVC. It's folded into 4 bits, but it's got these like plastic sleeves, which you can then slot in actual cards, and it will give you like a fully formed map. But it's just so awkward and uncomfortable. It doesn't fold up well. It doesn't flatten very well. There's been a lot of comments online of people that it's rocked up with holes in it, or I don't know what the alternative could have been for them, because I like the idea. I love the idea of having a map. Like one of my favorite games growing up was the Ultima. I think I played Ultima 5 or Ultima 6, and it came with a cloth map. And I used to love, it doesn't matter what city I was in or where I was exploring, just to have that map next to you of the entire realm. And knowing what you could go and where you could go is really, really cool. But it is quite cumbersome and hard to use. And the other sort of issue I have with this game is that I don't know what to do with my top 10 now, because Seventh Continent is in my top 5, and I think this game is better. And so I don't know what to do about that. I think I'm just going to have to swap Continent out and put Citadel in, because I am loving this game.
Why is it better?
It's just... They've taken some of the things from the other one game that were a little bit clunky. Like the other game, had a crafting mechanism, which was great. If you could get this, and you could pick up this item, craft together, it's really, really powerful. But it was very rare to actually find both of those items to be able to use. Another thing that it had was if you had a sword, for instance, every time you used it, you'd put a dice on. Every time you used it, you'd lower the dice value by one, and eventually it would break and you'd have to discard it. This one, you don't have to. You get to keep it. If you use the sword and on a skill test that fails, then you roll the dice. And if you roll, I think, a one or a two, it breaks and you discard it. But otherwise, if you get a good weapon, you can continue to use it. I just feel as though you got more flexibility with the skills and the advanced skills that you get to actually select. At a certain point, you get to draw four advanced skills out of the box, keep two, and then put two back. And so you end up building up your deck, because the quests are going to get, or the adventures are going to get harder, but you're building your deck as you go. And the fact that you have a community as like your home base, so that's where you go out, do your quest, you come back, you return to base. There's a little story at the end that tells you whether you succeeded or failed, you met your objectives or only half of your objectives. You get a few things. It's usually moving up a few skill tracks or beginning to build another building, which then sets you in a better position for the next one. Seventh continent, you were only ever just returning to the island. Sort of, you're going to the island and try and break a new curse, whereas this one, you really have a home base that you can build, and you can build it in any way you want. There are a couple of buildings that you can only build if you've built a specific building prior to that. But when you're first starting off, you can go in any direction you want. You can build whatever you want. You can not focus on buildings and actually focus on your personal skills if you want. It just feels more like an RPG. It feels more like a game that you can completely take ownership of your character, even to the point where there's only four characters you choose from at the start, but there's a male and a female version as well, which is also a nice touch, I think.
What about you, Mitch? Just briefly, quickly, how do you feel about it?
I'm kind of mixed on it. I enjoyed it. I think the mechanisms in the game, like the stars things and the, you know, choosing how many cards you want to turn over and things like that, I think that's good. Playing the game was fine. Really good narrative and things like that, story to follow along with. The issue that I had with it was that I think it's a bad decision to make the intro, the learning modules, as difficult as they are. Because my experience, I haven't played Seventh Citadel Continent before, so this is new to me. And the experience that I had was that I enjoyed the game while I played it, but what happened at the end, at the end of the prologue, you go to, there's a summary at the end, like an epilogue, where you go through and you say, and it says to you, did you uncover, you know, card number 35. If so, read this. Did you uncover, you know, and this, I think it was about five or six of them where it said, did you make these things happen in the story? Now, those things only happen in the story if you are successful at the different challenges at different points in the story as you're going along. Of the six that were available in the epilogue that you could read and see what happened in the story, I achieved exactly zero of them. Not a single one. So what my experience was, and I don't know if they've had this in playtesting, was I've just missed out on six parts of that game because I wasn't good enough, or it was too hard for me to figure out as a new player in order to achieve any of those six. So the feeling for me going then, okay, I'm going to get, do I have a motivation to kick on and jump into the second scenario or the next threat? No, because I feel like I've missed out on everything that I was supposed to find out about or learn about, or even any of that stuff that I would have got some enjoyment from in the first learning module. I failed all of them.
Yeah.
Now that may be because I'm a terrible player. Okay. Maybe I need to go back and play it again and you know, do better and learn my way through it. But I thought if it's a game where you're gonna play it once and experience the whole story and then you're done, then sure, make it hard. Because I'm an advocate for that, right? Especially with solo games. I say you don't want to have success your first time out, because then you'll be like, well, I've already beat it. What am I going back for? But this isn't a game where you play the one scenario and you're done. This is a game where, you know, the challenge should ramp up as you go through the campaign and you get to the end of it. Another game that I can think of that does a similar thing, Robinson Crusoe. The very first mission is nearly impossible. And so many people I've spoken to have said, oh, don't try the first mission. Just go straight to the second mission because the first one is like the hardest in the game. Why would you do that? like why would you when you're building a campaign game, you've got the opportunity throughout the entire course of content to gradually make the difficulty get harder. I just don't know why you would come out hard out of the gates. But Dan has told me, you know, we've spoken about it, and Dan said, you know, you've got to, you know, keep going with it, keep going with it, because it does get better. It does get better after the intro. So I think that's a bit of a miss. That's not a knock on the game. That's a knock on the designers. Why would you do that?
And it's a fair criticism, to be honest. If they want to, and I keep referring to it, I keep referencing like PC games, but really when PC games do it, they almost, I don't know whether grandfathering is the right term, but they step it out a lot easier. So the prologue would be, here's how to do an action, here's how to do your skill tests. And now it's here to do the skill test where they cascade. And now here's to do the skill test, whereas the prologue does dump a lot of it straight at your feet, right from the get-go. That's a very, very steep learning curve. One of the reasons I think they've done it, though, is because once you finish the prologue and you then start at the settlement, that's it. Then you now choose a threat book, and there's two threat books and a third one, and you can play them in any order. So they don't know what threat you're going to choose, so that they can't sort of then lead into the rest of the mechanisms. They need to really put it right at the front of the game. And the other thing is, if you die and finish that's at the end of the game during the middle of a threat, you're supposed to then start again at the prologue, choose a new character and start again. So hopefully the second time you play it, even though it is a tough prologue, you'll get through it a lot quicker. The other thing is, the prologue takes a lot longer than most of the games that I've played so far, because they do put a lot of stuff up
cram
front.
A lot of stuff in there.
Absolutely. So I understand why they've done it. I don't know whether it was a wise choice or not. And that also may be the reason why it took me so long to actually start the game. I did the prologue, and I was like, okay, a lot of it felt familiar because I'd played a lot of Seventh Continent before, but there were new things to learn, and I did notice certain things that I think they had refined. And the other thing that they've done a lot more, they put a lot more effort into the lore. This is really, really rich. A lot of it is up front in the prologue, where it explains a lot of stuff. But the dialogue book comes with a massive sort of glossary of what all these different things are. They've put a lot of thought into the different factions and the different sects and the world itself, the different creatures. The seventh continent was really just the flora and the fauna and some weird mechanisms and things where you're like, why is that there on this island? That was part of the mystery, but it didn't need a lot of backstory. This has so much backstory and lore, and maybe they've put too much emphasis on that and not enough on sort of helping people, easing people into the game. But I really do think that if you tough it out, anyone who plays this will find it a really rewarding experience.
Nice. And that was Seventh Citadel. Dan, I hope you can continue the campaign, man, and love it.
It's really, it's a bit of a beast to set up and pack down with all the cards and stuff, but that's part of the fun as well.
Yeah, sick. We will move on to my sizzle, and I'm going to jump straight in to say, and it is Wormspan. We were lucky enough to get sent a copy from Stonemaier Games. It's designed by Connie Vogelman, and I have to say, this is already way better than Wingspan. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate. I already had it. It's fine. I get that. Like, I feel that I'm just going to say straight out the gate, the theme of Wingspan, I definitely prefer it. I like the birds. I like the natural stuff. I like the information on the cards and the regions where they're from in the world and all that kind of stuff. But the mechanics and the mechanisms and the gameplay in Wormspan, I prefer. And kind of like how Dan was talking about before, that Seven Citadel is built on the foundations of already a very solid base of Seventh Continent, I feel that Wormspan has the same advantage. I feel that it's been built on an already great foundation of Wingspan, so it's been able to be played with and modified and changed to make it an interesting experience and a very different playing experience. So I don't know if you guys played Wormspan yet.
No, I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Dan, because I actually think you'd enjoy this game quite a lot. Because
That's two tonight now. What are you doing to me?
I know, sorry. Get your wallet out. Anyway, I feel that, like, this has just more interesting mechanisms and more interesting card play in this game compared to Wingspan. I feel Wingspan is great, and it, like I said before, it's built on the foundations of a great game. Like, it's awesome. And then this, they've just taken that idea and they've just evolved it, and they've made it, in my eyes, better. In some other players' eyes, maybe not so. Maybe they are more attached to the theme and they feel that they have enough from Wingspan. But I feel this offers me more choice when I'm playing. Like, I'm actually really having to think what I want to do. And that's what I like. I really want to be not struggling for choice, but like struggling to think what is the best and most efficient way to run this right now. I find that Wingspan doesn't do that as much. And I find that this has an interesting mechanic in the fact that you're essentially excavating out a cave, right? And you place these cave cards on your tableau before you can place a dragon on top. Because if you haven't excavated out the cave, the dragon can't build a den in that area.
Right.
And that's basically the very first action. And the actions are all coins. You pay coins to do it. And the more you do the action in that round, the more expensive the action becomes. So if you want to keep running the tableau across the top, let's say in the Crimson Cavern, which is the top row of caves, the first time you do it, costs a coin. The second time you do it, it's a coin and an egg. And then the third time you do it, it's a coin, an egg, and another egg, right? So they get more expensive. So you're kind of having to sort of jump between the different rows more, whereas I find that in Wingspan, once I've got myself set up in a good area, being that in the ponds, the fields, or the woodlands, I find that I tend to just keep running that same row almost again and again, trying to just build up eggs to place out on my birds to get points. Whereas this, it doesn't really have that as much. And there's interesting mechanisms in the fact that when you send the explorer out, there's all these other actions on the board that as they explore and go through the cave and activate different things, there's different benefits to being either in the Crimson Caves, the Golden Grotto, or the Amethyst Abyss, which is essentially the three different rows. And main part of it is this thing called the Dragon Guild. Then you have this other board that's a central board that sits in the middle of the table. And when you activate the Dragon Guild, you move your token around the Dragon Guild. And as you've moved it around, once you move it all the way around, it's almost like a clock. Once you've moved it all the way around, you get to place one of your cubes on one of the abilities on the central part of that board. And that central part of the board is a card which can be swapped out for different games. And I think there might be 8 or 10 in total. So it adds a lot of variability to the game itself. Sometimes you're like, oh yeah, I want to hit that Dragon Guild hard, get my mark around, get the best ability, because they are finite. They're not, you know, you can't necessarily all get the same actions. And you get your marker, you place it on, and you do the really cool ability, which might be, you know, get 2 coins and 2 eggs for free. And then you're like, sweet, that's 2 extra actions I can take this round. Because at the end of the round, the coins discard, I believe, down to 6 or something like that. But then you have to entice dragons, just like in Wingspan, which is just paying the cost of the dragons, which is to do with the different resources, of which there's 4. There's also like baby dragons, which tend to not be able to place eggs on them, but they have really cool abilities, which if played early can really benefit you long term of the game. Yeah, it really feels like Wingspan 2.0. That is how I feel about it, and I really enjoyed it. I think it was brilliant. So
what would you say the step up is in difficulty, though? Because like, Wingspan was so popular because it was like the go-to gateway game, but from what I've heard about Wormspan, it doesn't feel as gateway-ish. Is that true?
I would agree with that. It's definitely more crunchier in the fact that you really have to have a little bit more foresight in where things are going and how you want to play certain cards and
what cards you want to pick up, because not only are you picking up bird cards, you're picking up different types of caves as well, and all those caves have abilities on them that when placed you get an ability, or maybe when a dragon gets placed on there you get an ability. They have all these different things that have knock-on effects that will affect the game later on. So I find I like that decision space. For me, that's my style of gaming. That's what I like. I like having to really think about my actions and what I get to do. Whereas Wingspan is definitely a little bit more chilled, a little bit more relaxed, like you said, maybe slightly more gateway. But the complexity of the game itself isn't much harder. It's more in the decision space. Like that's where the sort of complexity would be increased. To play the game, essentially all you have to do is place a cave before you can place a dragon. That's really it. But the way that that works and the way you can try and combo these cards together, that can be the difference between getting 70 points and 90 points. Do you know what I mean? So you really, if you really crunch it out, you can do really, really well. So that's really all I have to say about Wingspan. I mean, it's we've talked about Wingspan ad nauseum. It's basically Wingspan 2.0. I'll probably never play Wingspan again, if I'm honest.
Okay, wow.
Like, I prefer this out of the box, like, as it is. And, yeah, I never bought the European expansion to Wingspan. I only had Oceania and the base game. But I feel that I get more out of this mechanically than I do out of Wingspan. So,
and the expansion as well.
And the Oceania expansion, yes, agreed. Yeah. But like I said, I do prefer the bird theme because the it comes with a – look, everyone's going to hate me on this, but it's okay. It comes with a dragon facts book, which obviously aren't facts because dragons aren't real, and that annoyed me.
That was going to be my first question. Who decided on those facts?
Yeah.
Or they just tailored the facts to suit the game.
Yeah. I mean, they really did. Because, like, the aerial recluse spends most of its time at an altitude of 9,000 to 12,000 meters, which is approximately 30,000 to 40,000 feet. Although it typically stays well away from humans, its mating season frequently disrupts air travel. So, for me...
Of course it does.
And I mean, like, I thought that the bird cards were so interesting and so great. And I really did like that they showed the little map with the region of where they all from. And they talk about migration patterns and obviously the wingspan of the actual bird and all these other really interesting details that I never would have picked up before and never spoken about. Obviously, we all love the bin chicken. It gave us a big hurrah when we were over here seeing that. But I really just found that was unnecessary. Like, for me, there's just a piece of paper that is.
But there are things, I mean, but is it not needed, or do you need to know certain things about the dragons in order to feel like.
Nope.
So you don't need to know that dragon lives in the Emerald Cave, or that dragon lays one egg a turn, or whatever
they're
else.
They're all
or,
on the cards. So
right.
It tells you on the cards that the trait is helpful. And some cards will be like, if you have. You know, you score extra points for having four helpful dragons in that row, or you might get more for having three shy dragons in the column and things like that. But look, it's a nice little book, but I'm never going to look at it. I like facts to be facts. So that's a fact. So, but yeah, other than that, it's brilliant. Like,
Jack.
If you liked Wingspan and you want more of it, definitely get this. If you liked Wingspan and your friends and family enjoyed Wingspan, I think that they would get a lot out of this. I think that they'd see the similarities and they would enjoy the game, right? Because there's lots of games that we pick up and we're like, oh, it's just like that other game that we've already played, but it's slightly different and it's got this and it's got this extra mechanic in it and I like that. And we still buy them and play them lots. And I feel that this is for the people that like Wingspan, they would. I mean, Dan, you bought Seventh Citadel and you had Seven Continent, you hadn't finished it, right?
Yeah. I think there was a couple curses I hadn't, but I'm just glad hearing more about it now. I'm just glad they didn't just reskin it with dragons and go, ta-da, it's Wormspan. Like, I'm glad they have actually changed some of it up with a new, there's another central board and all this sort of stuff as well. Good.
That was my original sort of preconceived notion about it, was that, oh, they're just reskinning Wingspan and just making bank, because why not? Because it's just printing
people
money.
Love it's like, did a round table, Jamie and his mates went, people love dragons, don't they? Why don't we just make the dragons?
Exactly. But no, they haven't. They've made a really enjoyable game built on a system that really works. So
cool.
What can you say? And that is Wormspan by Connie Vogelman, produced by Stonemaier Games. Cool. And with that, we shall move on to a little bit of news. Dan, would you like to take over this segment? Because I know that you're big on to it.
Yeah, I can do it quickly. We've got two big things we want to mention. The first one is coming up this Friday. We have our next Patreon trivia night. I love running trivia, but this time I get to participate because Chris, who's one of our Patreons, he's taking charge of this one. He's taking the reins of the Quizmaster General. So it's going to be at 8:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time in our Patreon lounge, and that's for all Patreons. And I'm going to be there. So
there's a lot of people going to be there. There's a lot of people signed up. I'm keen as. I can't wait.
It's going to be exciting. And then, of course, we've been talking about this for a few weeks now, but the fourth annual Board Game Barbecue Awards, they are coming. We're going to kick off in May. So the nominations will start or will open on May the 1st, and they'll run for a few weeks. So you can check our socials starting next week. We'll give more information on how to vote. There'll be a form you can fill out, and you can vote on any game across all nine categories. You can vote on any game that was released according to BGG in 2023. So if those of you that haven't voted before, we have eight categories up for grabs. There's best solo game, best party game, best light game, medium game, and heavy game. There's also best artwork, best expansion, and, of course, game of the year. So it's open to anyone in our community can vote. But what happens is once the nominations close, we'll take the most popular nominations in each category. They'll become the official nominees for each category. And we'll turn it over to our esteemed panel of judges, which are our Patreons. And our Patreons will decide who wins the Board Game Barbecue Awards for 2023. So as I said, nominations will open on May the 1st. Check our socials next week. We'll have all the information on how to vote, and you can get amongst it and hopefully decide who the Board Game Barbecue Award winners are going to be.
Sweet. Thanks for that, Dan. And with that, we shall move on to the question of the pod.
You know that game you've been wanting for a long, long time? The one that's been on your wish list for ages? Yeah, that one. The one you've been adding to your cart and taking off again, umming and ahhing about whether you should get it or not? Well, I'm here to push you over the edge and say go to adventgames.com and add that to your cart right now. I bet you that Dean has a great price on it, he's got great customer service, flat rate shipping, and there's so many other goodies to explore on the website. Wonderful categories all organized to pick the exact game that's right for you and the group that you play with. So head over now, don't hesitate, to adventgames.com.au and add that game to your cart now.
Last week's question was, which board game would make the most interesting movie or TV show? Did you guys have any thoughts on this?
I actually really enjoyed this question. I enjoyed looking at my game collection and trying to think what would be what would make some interesting television or movies. One that jumped out at me is Atlantis Rising. I thought the idea of a civilization that is scrambling because all the peninsulas are starting to sink, and they're trying to create this technology. That even the expansion that came out with the monsters and gods and monstrosities, that would be an interesting sort of interesting twist on it as well. And the most obvious one that came to mind, and it was mentioned a couple of times on our socials, but it didn't come out as much as I expected it to, is a really well put together proper Arkham Investigator series or something. I'm not even sure the whole Cthulhu mythology has been explored that well in television and movies, but we're talking proper like mysteries with the investigators and stuff. I think that would make a sick sort of 10-part Netflix series or something. I don't know. I'd love to see that.
X-Files well, kind of thing.
Exactly.
That would be awesome. HBO did it a couple of years ago, right?
It wasn't something, and it had like an Arkham theme, but I didn't hear great things about it. I don't know how far it delved into the whole Cthulhu mythology. I'd love to see something like that.
Cool. What about yourself, Mitch? Anything stands out for you?
Too many bones. That's too the answer. Bones. Move on.
Peter Jackson. Got to be Peter Jackson, right?
Be great. Yeah, 100%. It'd be awesome. I'd watch it.
Sold. Sick. What about you, Adrian?
For me, I would go with Scythe because I think it like writes itself like almost a Game of Thrones-esque, no one's really in the right, and it's sort of all these different factions around this sort of weird dystopian kind of Europe sort of alternate past. I think it would be great. I'd get Nolan involved. That's where I'd be going with that, straight up. So,
Another one I just thought of that would be awesome, Coloma. If they made like a Western movie or TV show where they're like cowboys.
That would never work.
Nah, no one would watch that.
I thought another cute, like a Disney one would be like Fit to Print with like animals, like in a la sort of Zootopia, but it's like an animal-esque sort of newspaper and they've got deadlines to meet and something like that could be kind of cool. But anyway.
Cool. Well, Mitch, would you like to read a couple of the Facebook answers out from the community?
I can do that. So Ian Third has said, lots of story-driven games like Tainted Grail, Sleeping Gods, Gloomhaven, etc. Root could be interesting. A bit Wind in the Willows. I always wanted to see a Wind in the Willows expansion to Root, navigating the Wildwood and taking back Toad Hall from the Weasels. That would be awesome.
In that old style as well, in that real old... That would be amazing. I'd watch
Absolute classic. That would be awesome. Stuart McCune says, I think Brass Birmingham would make a really interesting period drama. Lots of devious business competition in an era of amazing process. With Gerard Butler as the lead, if we can't get Daniel Day-Lewis, it would be good.
You better hope you get Daniel Day-Lewis because Gerard Butler's gone downhill, but.
Thomas James says Scythe would make a great TV show. Tainted Grail would be great too. Twilight Imperium would make a good movie series.
Oh, imagine that. That would be
awesome. TI.
Just don't get Zack Snyder to touch it ever.
Yeah, that would be epic. That would be an absolute home run.
Sure.
Ingrid Wright says a movie version of Australia would be fun with Eric Banner and Guy Pearce as Cthulhu and Shoggoth. Can you imagine that with those two? And let's put Hugh Jackman there as general of the troops on the ground, staged in iconic Australian locations. There'd have to be a cameo by Martin Wallace, of course.
Alfred Hitchcock style, he'd be reading a newspaper or something in the background.
Yeah. And Taryn Hoffman says, I'd definitely watch an animated movie based on the Flamecraft Dragons. I'm too familiar with the Flamecraft Dragons, but it sounds like something that'd be interesting.
On Instagram, we had Bored to Laughter say, Wynwood, steampunk sci-fi on a gas planet with ships and space whales. That would be amazing. With the success of Dune, like I could see that being like, I'd just be really concerned that all of these would just get bodged and they wouldn't be as good as my mind thinks they're going to be. Dan, did you want to read a couple of the Discord ones out?
Yeah, Kev 981 said Lost Ruins of Arnak could be a great adventure movie or a TV show about competing teams of archaeologists, Under Falling Skies, an epic globe-trotting alien invasion, Clank in Space or other variants, a comedic heist movie where you find characters that remind you of the other genre tropes. There's some good suggestions there. Sub-Zero Joe said, surely has some potential for Too Many Bones. Imagine a 90s cartoon style, but with gear locks. Very cool. Ray said, I'm sure Gloomhaven / Frosthaven will get a run one day. Would also love to see Munchkin and Clank. There's another vote for Clank. Spenny said, got to be Food Chain Magnate. I don't know about that.
I wish he'd extrapolated on that one. Yeah. When I read that, I was a bit like, how? Like, is it competing like franchises? I don't know.
Don't know. And Uberface said, "I'm trying to think of themes IPs that haven't been done. Heaps of TV shows, movie. My picks are Vagrant Song, Ice, Resist, and Legacy of You. That'd be a great one too. Yep, building out the canals with the barbarians knocking on the door, trying to smash the villagers up. That'd be very cool."
Sick. Okay, so thank you very much for your answers, everybody. We really do appreciate people writing in and letting us know their thoughts. But this would not be the Board Game Barbecue Podcast without a new question of the pod. So we will move on to what makes an RPG game an RPG game? Mitch, would you like to... Yeah, would you like to...
Can I give a bit of a background?
Explain yourself, Mitchell.
Explain this.
So I'm going to wear this question. This was one from me. So I don't recall what triggered it the other day. I was having a sort of a thought process. Lauren and I have kind of been going back and forth with a few different games, and we've been, and Dan as well has also been looking into the sort of solo RPG games and stuff like that and the narrative. And as those of you who have listened to some of our earlier episodes, you may have heard me talk about the fact that I came from a bit of a D&D background, which is where I first ever heard the term RPG. That was back when that was role playing. They were role playing games, and you know, the TTRPG has since been stapled on to qualify that it's a tabletop RPG. Because since then, we've seen video games come out that are RPGs. We've got board games that are considered RPGs. There's you know, all sorts of different things that you can consider RPGs. So I thought, well, what actually is required in a game in order for it to be labeled an RPG, which stands for role-playing game, right? So that's where I'm coming from. So I thought, well, this would be interesting to ask the community, you know, what do you think should be included in a game, or should at least be a component of a game before you can call it an RPG? I'll let you guys answer first, and then I'll give you my take on it. So what do you think, Adie?
I really feel if it's an RPG, it has to be character driven, like, and a high amount of narrative based. So story driven experience that's evolved around a character that you play, and you are assigned a role. Your role is, I am this character, and we are exploring this and doing these different things as the character I'm playing, not necessarily role playing it. I don't have to role play being the knight if I don't want to, but it has to be a story driven game where I would react to things as if I was that character. I might not have to put on the posh voice or the I'm a little warlock, you know, or whatever. Like, I don't have to do that part of it, but not I can just
late night MJ voice.
That- no, exactly. I don't have to do any of that. I just have to be immersed in the experience. So for that reason, I do not class Too Many Bones as an RPG. I feel that it's a board game where you play these characters. Yes, you are assigned a role, but I feel that it lacks the narrative and story, that interaction between characters, to make it what I would like to determine as an RPG. Because we might bash things and smash things and we do all these different things together, but the things that I say as my character do not have any sway in the game or change of anything to a character that's opposite me. It's all mechanical based, the story, the events, the event deck. I feel that I need to be able to say, I am the leader, we are doing this thing, and we're not going to go there, and we're going to do this, and then the other characters will react to that situation.
I agree. And I'm having sort of over the last 12 months dived in I've dived into a lot of sort of solo RPG or sort of the print and play style ones. A lot of them pass themselves off as RPG when it's really just picking a character that assigns you stats, and then it's just crash and bash. It's dungeon crawling, or it's doing certain things. You might be even drawing a map and stuff. But where's the role? Where's the play? I get that I'm fighting things, and I am a barbarian, so I have X attack and I have X defense, and I can pick up weapons that are unique to me. But that doesn't mean that it's actually I'm not playing a role per se. So I think that's the key, and probably the best examples of it are when the DM actually changes the story to suit the players and puts the players in situations where there's the social element. I think a good, and not that I've played very many, in fact, but one of the only ones I've played was Mitch, when Mitch was the dungeon master for us. And that was all about our roles. Like, we had to create our roles right from the get-go and, you know, provide a backstory and stuff so that Mitch could then sort of feather that through the story as it progressed. And yeah, the best parts, the most fun parts, when you're casting spells and I'm going to move here and I'm going to attack this one, you take that one, all that sort of stuff. But the important parts are the social aspect, when you actually get to actually immerse yourself in a role and the story revolves around the characters, as opposed to just go here, fetch that, smash that thing up and then go back to the tavern kind of thing.
Hmm. I think I agree with both of you in what you said. And I think Adrian's probably going to be surprised that I agree that I don't really view Too Many Bones as a role-playing game. It's more a battle strategic combat game than a role-playing. And I think the key for me comes down to, as Dan said, those two words, role-play. What role are you playing? If you're just controlling a character that really has no personality, no story, no role, then you're not really role-playing. I agree with you, Adrian, that I think a role-playing game needs to have a strong story and narrative, and your decisions influence the narrative and that story, as opposed to just combat outcomes. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, where I'm sort of sitting on it. But I know that there's going to be a lot of people that disagree, right? Because if you touch into the video game world, particularly, there's role play. There's games out there they'll call RPGs, but really they're just character advancement, like skill tracks. You put a skill track in a game that you get to choose what skills you're going to, you know, build up on your character, and they call it an RPG. But they're not really playing the role; they're just developing the skills of sort of, you know, a hollow character.
So I have quite a lot of experience with the online aspect of this. Including running guilds and being part of one of the biggest guilds in Europe for World of Warcraft way back when it started. And I would agree with that, but there's also, it's broken up quite a lot. So World of Warcraft as an example, rather than EverQuest and EverQuest 2 and Ultima Online and things like that, World of Warcraft did it really well. They did online PvE. So I can't attack you if you're a different faction. It's like a Euro game. I just wander around and everything's fine and I can do whatever I like. Then there's PvP, where if I see you, I can just attack you because you're a different faction to me and we can fight in the middle of the street. Guards will come and break us up, or, you know, if I'm a different faction to the guards, they'll attack me and you'll just be the victor. They also had RP PvP, which is role-playing PvP. So people in those servers do role-play their characters. Right. To the point of, like, I've been booted out of a few different things before because I was 15, 16, had no idea, logged in, jumped straight in playing a game, and because I wasn't role-playing it properly, they were reporting me. So people do take it to that level. Granted, it would be the smallest of smallest niche, like it would be the 1% that would do it, but it is possible to do it on there. But I feel that the MMORPG, so the massively multiplayer online RPG, I think that's what MMORPG stands for, I feel they get their strength through the community because they are a community-based thing. They are hacking and slashing still. I feel that their sort of RPG is more based around the community and let's all meet up to smash bash crash this boss. Whereas I think the tabletop one is the regular meeting of a group of friends and people bringing people together and enjoying this experience together. I feel that they're a little bit different, but my only recent experience was with the Alice is Missing thing.
Yes.
And yep. I mean, I will tell you, my heart was beating hard during that whole thing because I was the one, people don't know this, but I was the one that was left on my own. And I went and investigated. I went to the to the location. I don't want to, you know, give away any spoilers, but I was on my own and it was up to me to do the thing. And I was having to type all this stuff. And I knew that I had a timer where I was going to basically get killed or booted out of the game and I couldn't tell anyone anymore. And I was frantically typing as fast as I could to try and relay as much information over as possible. Then my line went dead and then it's just silence. And watching all the replies, I was like, wow, this is pretty deep. Like, I am well immersed in this experience. Would I do it again? Yes, but I probably wouldn't do it as a regular thing. I would love to do it again in like a year's time when I've kind of forgotten about a lot of it. But the D&D side of things is a very different experience. You want to meet up regularly. You need to build your character. You will have this history of lore. I mean, there's some D&D campaigns I've seen on YouTube, like World Records, that are going for like 25 years and 30 years because they're just playing this same campaign. And that I find amazing. Like, I find that huge.
But bringing it back to board games a little bit, like if you look at, say, let's take like Kingdom Death Monster. I know that's, I choose that because you're obviously very familiar with that. Would you call that a role-playing game?
No.
You wouldn't call that an RPG because even though you're building up your character.
Yeah, you are building up a character, but the character turnover in that game is so quick. You're dying and getting a new one, dying and getting a new one. You're just going through a new life constantly. You're not really emotionally attached to any of the characters. Granted, the population is your extra lives. So if you've got a population of 16, you have 16 lives, right? Whereas in an RPG, I feel that you are the character. If you die, it's like, it's game over. You know, they have to drag you back to a cleric and get a resurrection spell and bring you back from the dead. And the DM will be like, while you were dead, like he'll tell you on the side, like while you were dead, you saw this ethereal plane and it gave you this message that said you had to get to this place. And if you get to this place, you will, you know, grow wings and become like an angel or something, you know. And there's all this sort of evolving story that constantly changes. It's just a bit different. And they're just,
so do we think if we take video games out of the equation, right, we're talking TTRPG, which is tabletop role-playing games, your traditional D&D style tabletop RPGs, is there anything else? Gloomhaven, Sleeping Gods, you know, any of these other dungeon crawlery type board games, are we, the three of us, at this point in time, sitting here saying, not RPGs? There's no RPGs in board gaming.
I mean, I said, when I was talking about Seventh Citadel, I said it's the closest I've come to RPG because you have a bit of free reign. It feels open, but it's still, it's story driven. Regardless, it's the same story regardless of what character you play. The closest I can think of is in terms of solo RPGing is the journaling ones. Like I've talked about Thousand-Year-Old Vampire. I was going to say Thousand-Year-Old Vision.
But again, I'd say that's vampire, closer to it.
But because it's purely prompt-based and then it's you're the one that actually plays the character and just based on the prompts that you get, you create the story. That's the closest I think I've ever played to a solo RPG. When it's purely prompt-based, it's not here's a door, do you open it, yes or no? That's not the same thing. It's something happened in your past or someone from your past came back. Go. And you journal whatever the hell you want, whatever comes to you, whatever you want, whatever direction your character goes to, that's completely immersive in terms of playing a role.
I think the clue was almost in your own question then, Mitch. You said, do we consider any of these other dungeon crawlers to be an RPG? That's not to disparage the dungeon crawler genre. We love them. I mean, KDM's my number two game of all time. It's brought me the best experience of my gaming life, but it isn't what I would consider an RPG.
And I ask that question, like I sit on the same fence as what I think you guys are at the moment in terms of coming from a D&D background. I always, in my head, RPG means I'm taking on the role of that character. I'm trying to put myself in the head of that character and say, what would that character do in this point in time? And my decisions are based around the answers I come up with and I ask that question. So yeah, I think I sit on that side, but I don't know if the whole community are going to agree with us on that.
No, that's good. That's a discussion, right?
I can't wait to hear it.
And that's why I think it's a good question. That's why I think it's why I sort of thought it would pop it up as the question of the pod to see what are the different opinions out there. It's become such a sort of coverall term to say RPG, but what does it really mean to everybody?
Cool. We look forward to hearing your answers on all our different socials and different channels and the Discord, Facebook, and all those awesome places. So what makes an RPG game an RPG game? Right. Before we move on to the oaths, I just wanted to do a massive shout out and thanks to all our community members and also all our amazing Patreons. Thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate it. Please don't forget to vote for us. I mean, the votes are probably already over by the time on the BGG Golden Geek, but we really appreciate everyone that has voted for us behind the scenes. Fingers crossed we'll get that nomination again. Remember, if you want to support Board Game Barbecue, then you can head over to patreon.com/boardgamebarbecue, where you can get a bunch of exclusive podcasts, different random chats and stuff going on there. Also, there's an exclusive channel in our Discord for the Patreon Lounge, where we do the trivia nights and do all these other different things. And yeah, thank you very much for all your support. Appreciated. So, swear an oath. Well, my oath last time was salt and sea. And I got it done. Tick. Hooray. Awesome. And my next oath, it's going to be a long-term oath of about 2.5 months. So, fingers crossed I'll get it done.
Ken oath.
I bought a copy of Dune, the old school 70s style Dune board game, the six player kind of strategic warlike game, and also I also bought the play map, the large like 50% scaled up map, because I found it really hard to, when I looked at it, I looked at the original board, I haven't played on the original board, but I've seen pieces on it and it looks very congested. And I just wanted to have that full experience. And I got them on sale. And yeah, I want to teach a group Dune. That would be my ideal goal. And then to try and play it a few times. I have played it a few times with another group. Really appreciated all those games. But I know that there's some people like Matt Woods who loves Dune, loves the Dune lore, but has never had the opportunity to play it. So I kind of used him as my excuse to buy it because I always wanted to have it in my collection. So cheers, Matt. Appreciate your being my excuse management team. So yeah, Dune. What about you, Mitch?
Well, what about me? I had sworn an oath to play a game called Endurance, which is a solo game that was loaned to me by Lauren. And I have completed that. I've done it. It's actually a pretty cool premise. It's a historically accurate. It's based on history of a Arctic campaign by a bunch of people. I don't know who they were. I'd have to look into it a bit more. But they basically, it was a long time ago. There was a whole bunch of people that went on this expedition to the poles, and their ship got crushed by ice and sank. And then they all had to make their way out and try and survive, essentially. Thus the title, Endurance. It's a bit daunting when you're reading the rule book and it says, you're not supposed to win this game. There is no win condition. There's just survive for as long as you can. And don't be surprised if you don't, basically, because no one expected you to, nor did they expect any of the people who were actually on the real expedition to survive. I won't spoil it and tell you what actually did happen to the people in the real expedition, but
that's a pretty cool premise though.
Yeah, it is. So the game is, it's super hard. Let's just start off by saying that it's super hard and you've got crew members expiring all over the place. But I don't know. It was just I didn't feel like there was a lot of agency of what you could do. You could try to pass tests and achieve that. You essentially turn over cards, and there's like challenges. There's a skill challenge, and but you didn't really get to choose too much about what you could do. But I guess it's kind of thematic because there's not a lot of when you're in a situation like that where there's, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles of ice around you. I guess you don't really have a lot of choices to what you can do. But it was okay. I'm not going to say it was a terrible game. I'm not going to say it was a great game. I feel a bit bad because Lauren said, oh, you'll really like it. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It was just one of those, oh, yeah. I really enjoyed the history side of it. I really enjoyed reading about the crew and what happened and all that sort of stuff. The game fell a little bit flat for me. But I played it, so we can tick that box. And in terms of my next oath, I, after hearing Dan bang on about Seventh Citadel and how good it is, and the chats that we've had even before this episode about the follow-up scenarios, I'm going to swear an oath to make an effort to get it out and progress past the prologue and see how the game is after the intro.
Oh, I'm glad. Yep.
Yep. No, because I really want to like it. I think it's a game that could really fit in my wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Nice. That's me. And yourself, Dan? Is this 3 for 3?
Well, yeah, my oath was to play more Seventh Citadel, which I did, so that I could talk about it. Like I said, I made it my oath not just to play it initially, but I made it an extended oath to play more of it. So I wasn't giving just first impressions. So that's a tick. Although I haven't put on the run sheet that I did have a second oath, which I haven't fulfilled yet. And that was to play the solo RPG game book Project Echo, which I picked up from Conan and the team at Games Paradise. So that's going to have to carry on till next time.
Well, there's no better time, right? With a question of the pod. So,
well, yeah, that's it. Well, this is prompt-based solo RPG. This is one where you're actually moving through time. And instead of putting it into a journal, you put it into an actual day planner because you move through time throughout the day planner. It's a wicked, wicked concept. But my new oath is going to be to play Creature Comforts. So this is a game that I picked up from More Than Meeples when I was up in Brisbane. I actually bought Creature Comforts and Maple Valley. And I really like the style of the KTBG series, the kids' table board games. I've been eyeing off Dice Veggies for when that comes to Australia. There's also Wasabi, there's Fossilis. There's a whole bunch of it in the range. They're really, really well produced. And I was thinking, because I'm moving on all of our Harbour games for the kids, and I wanted to fill that gap with a bunch of other sort of a range of games that are a little bit of a step up for the family. And so we're going to start with Creature Comforts. So
you're going to move them on, Dan. The Harbour games.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Not going to keep them for grandkids one day? Like, sentimental?
I do not think so. No. I've got enough games that I'm collecting. I've got enough games in my collection that I'm hanging on to just because. I don't need to keep those ones as well.
I was going to throw in a granddad joke for Dan, but then I realised I'm probably closer to being granddad than he is. So.
You're a lot older than mine. Although I've seen Brad's moves and you've got nothing to worry about. So anyway, I swear to play Creature Comforts by the time I'm on the pod next, and I'll fill you in on how that went.
Cool. Well, that's 3 for 3, and I think we'll end it there. Thank you very much for joining us, everyone. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks, Aidy.
No, thank you, guys. It's been fun.
And good night. See you at the next one. Play more games.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.